China hits out of the U.S. for its stance over Taiwan, calling on Washington to stop smearing Beijing and harming its interests. The Venezuelan president meets with Iran's leader and hails Tehran's support for Caracas in its fight against the United States. Also in the headlines, cargo transport remains stalled in South Korea's industrial hubs. A strike by truckers over high pay enters its sixth day. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The exchange of heated rhetoric continues between China and the United States. Beijing is now calling on Washington to stop smearing China and harming its interests. The tough words came in reaction to the U.S. Defense Secretary accusing China of destabilizing military activity near Taiwan. Defense Minister Wei Fenghe says that China will fight to the very end to ensure that Taiwan remains part of the country. According to Wei, anyone who attempts to split the Chinese territory will come to no good end. He also said that Beijing wants peace but is opposed to providing weapons to Taiwan. Wei noted that it's up to the U.S. to improve bilateral ties. Tensions are soaring between the two sides. The United States says that China's flights near Taiwan are provocative. Beijing accuses Washington of pushing Taipei toward independence. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that experience has shown that resistance is the only way toward victory against America's pressure campaigns. In a meeting with the Venezuelan president, Ayatollah Khamenei said that Iran and Venezuela have managed to defeat the U.S. hybrid warfare. The leader said that Washington imposed the most severe sanctions on Tehran under the so-called maximum pressure campaign, but Iran managed to defuse the U.S. plot through resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei welcomed the signing of a 20-year cooperation deal between Iran and Venezuela, urging efforts to implement it. The leader said that Iran has proven it doesn't shy away from helping its friends when they are in danger. The Venezuelan president thanked Iran for its support for his country in the hard fight against the U.S. Nicolas Maduro said Tehran helped Caracas get out of a very difficult situation at a time when no other country supported the Latin American nation. He said Venezuela managed to resist a multidimensional U.S. war and is now better off compared to several years ago. Well, as you just heard, Iran and Venezuela have signed a 20-year cooperation document to focus on petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political cooperation. Our correspondent, Salman Kujuri, reports.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people.
Now, the relations between the two countries are in the best condition, and with the signing of the comprehensive roadmap of cooperation between the two countries, the path of deepening bilateral cooperation will be broadened more than before. We hope that with this increase of contacts and exchanges of visits in the future, the ground for implementing the 20-year document will be provided.
Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago. Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujri, Tehran.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says that the recent assassination of an IRGC colonel was a cowardly act and a proof of the enemy's despair in the face of Iran's power. He condoled with the family of Hassan Sayed Khodai during a visit to their home. The colonel was shot dead by two gunmen on a motorbike outside his house in an eastern Tehran neighborhood last month. He was a former Iranian military advisor in Syria. At the time, U.S. media reports hinted at Israel's involvement in his assassination. The commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps also pointed the finger at Zionist elements and promised to avenge his blood. Now moving on, South Korean truckers are on a strike for 6 days because their talks with the government over higher pay have failed to make a headway. Some 100 unionized truckers gathered outside a Hyundai factory in the southern city of Ulsan earlier today. Also on Saturday, some 7,000 were on strike. The truckers are protesting soaring fuel prices and demanding an extension of subsidies that are set to expire this year. Around 40 people have been arrested. Some of them were released later on. Transport ministry officials held a third round of negotiations with union leaders yesterday, but the two sides failed to narrow their differences. The strike is threatening South Korea's export of products such as cars and electronics and deepening uncertainty over global supply chains. Now, from Seoul, I'm joined by Jennifer Chang, our correspondent there. Jennifer, good to have you with us. So tell us how serious these strikes could be, what it would mean for South Korea. And the third round of talks just failed. So what's going to happen next?
Well, the outlook is not too good. And, of course, 27% of the 22,000-strong cargo truckers union under the Korean Federation of Trade Unions is on walkout right now. And this is affecting trade at Busan Port, which is South Korea's largest port and South Korea's second largest city. Over 75% of trade volume has fallen there, and at other ports around the country, trade volume has fallen 10% or more. So the South Korean government is in a real crisis, and scuffles have broken out between these truckers and police as the truckers attempt to prevent cargo trucks from going in and making deliveries. And the South Korean president had said violence is not acceptable, and they had arrested 40 or more of these truckers who were involved in the scuffles. Some were, of course, later released, but this is really getting serious. The truckers are demanding an extension of the 3-year safe freight system, whereby they get discounts on gasoline prices and they are guaranteed safe driving as they try to haul their cargo around the country to make ends meet. Right now, they say they are driving dangerously fast because they have to make ends meet, and gasoline prices here have soared to their highest ever level in years. This, of course, is due to the war in Ukraine and the embargo on Russian oil and gas. So there is no end in sight. Of course, the war in Ukraine is a prolonged war, and no one knows what's going to happen. This is not only affecting automobiles, but steel, construction, electronics, you name it. South Korea is an export-driven economy. It has to rely on these truckers, and the economy is in a serious crisis right now. The South Korean government is at a loss. They don't know what to do, and no one really can appease these truckers. We don't know what's going to happen. This is now in its sixth day, and right now the truckers show no signs of being appeased by the transport ministry, which tried to talk to them yesterday. The businesses, of course, the business lobby groups, they are under a financial burden. They are already under a burden because of the COVID pandemic that has been going on since 2020, and they just can't afford to pay these kinds of, you know, guaranteed freight rates and safe delivery prices and lower oil prices to the truckers. But the truckers say they need that kind of a discount on their gas and that kind of a insurance, so to speak. So we don't know what's going to happen. The South Korean economy is the 10th largest in the world right now, but it could be slipping as a result of this strike.
Okay, thank you so much for the explanation. Jennifer Chang, a correspondent in Seoul. A jailed Muslim leader in the Republic of Azerbaijan is on an open-ended hunger strike in protest at profane comments by interrogators. Leader of the Movement for Muslim Unity, Sheikh Taleh Bagherzadeh, has been refusing to eat for several days after learning about officers at the Bureau for Combating Organized Crime using profane language. The officers reportedly made a blasphemous comments while interrogating a group of Muslim activists. Bagherzadeh says he'll remain on hunger strike until all the offenders are put on trial. Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in Severodonetsk, one of Ukraine's last holdouts in eastern Donbass region. Kiev says it remains in control of a chemical plant there, where hundreds of civilians have taken shelter. According to Ukrainian officials, 800 people are hiding underneath the plant. A pro-Russia representative in Lugansk region, however, says about 400 Ukrainian troops are holed up there. The official says that those fighters are trying to negotiate their way out of the city, but such demands are unacceptable. Elsewhere, Kyiv has reported the death of 24 more children in the southeastern city of Mariupol that was captured by Russia in mid-May. The mayor there has reported a case of cholera and other infectious diseases, calling for more humanitarian aid. Meantime, Moscow says its air defense forces have shot down three Ukrainian warplanes in southern and northeastern Ukraine. And that's while Kyiv is asking the West for more weapons. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier to fill us in with the latest details about the situation in Ukraine's Donbass region.
Looks like Russian forces are in control of most of the city now. As President Zelensky says that this city represents the fight for Donbass. He's exaggerating when he says that there will be other battles before Russia is able to take the whole of Donbass. But Russia, this is an important victory that Russia is securing at the moment. As you rightly say, there is another Azov-style steel plant, if you like, another steel plant in which there are some fighters being hauled up in. There's reports there are some civilians there in which there's negotiations. Now, when in Mariupol, when Ukrainian soldiers stayed inside Azov-style steel plant, it was able to stop the Russian forces from sending troops elsewhere. If you like, holding up the Russian advance, if you will. So it's unclear whether maybe that's what Ukraine is trying to do again, hold up the Russian advance by keeping soldiers in a steelworks in the city of Severodonetsk. It was an interesting piece by the Guardian newspaper today, quite a staggering piece, actually. It said that between 600 and 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers were being killed or wounded every day, which, if that is true, it's a staggering number. Works out at about 20,000 a month. Obviously, these figures would be unsustainable for Ukraine. The article goes on to say that Ukraine is running out of ammunition. Many Ukrainians have admitted that they're running out of ammunition. So the article was saying very much this could be a turning point.
Since France's presidential and legislative elections were aligned in 2002, their chief executive has always been awarded a majority in parliament. But as France is heading for the first round of legislative vote, polls show President Macron's control over parliament may be in jeopardy. From Paris, Rami Mazahari has the story.
The day before France votes in their first round legislative elections, rallies were held around the country with two objectives. First, the far right is expected to win their greatest number of seats in 36 years, but that still only means less than 5% of the National Assembly. Second, the biggest question is, will President Emmanuel Macron retain his absolute majority and thus the ability to ram through more austerity-minded legislation? The left and Greens have surprisingly united, and the polls say Macron's coalition might get upset.
This government is not for the French people and for France, but is instead for the destruction of France. And look at the shameful police brutality at the recent Champions League final. That's what Yellow Vest have been enduring since November 17, 2018. And this government has just gotten worse and worse.
The Yellow Vests were a social revolt based around economic issues, and their list of demands are more relevant than ever. Lack of public services, low wages, high taxes, frozen pensions, and the increasing cost of the most essential goods are now major problems across the West. However, despite being the most popular social movement in recent French history, they aren't going to make major political inroads into parliament this election. Even if Macron's coalition doesn't win an outright absolute majority, their right-wing economic philosophy is certain to find support among the mainstream conservative party. They may dwindle to just 10% of seats, but that would be enough to keep parliament controlled by right-wing ideology. As first-round votes are often used for so-called protest votes, the results could be deceiving. The only certainty seems to be that Macronism has lost much of its appeal and momentum since 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic revolution is a divine revolution. The fact that this revolution belongs to the general public is one of the best tenets of the revolution. In this regard, there is no discrimination in favor of a particular social class. The second point is about a prophecy in the Imam's testament that the revolution would spread to other places and it will liberate the Muslim world from the clutches of colonialists. That was a prediction that our magnanimous Imam had made. When we look at the reality on the ground today, we see that his prediction has been fulfilled. Imam Khomeini's opinion, the revolution, unlike other revolutions, was not to be propagated by sowing the seeds of discord in other countries or by deploying military forces or by spreading terrorism, spreading the revolution among other nations, is to be realized through setting an example on the part of the Islamic Republic.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In other words, the Iranian nation should help the Islamic Republic reach a point and a position that when other nations look to it, they are filled with enthusiasm and are encouraged to follow in its footsteps. Such an initiative is to occur through propagating Islamic teachings, through public support of the oppressed groups within the Muslim world, and through supporting the oppressed nations that have been downtrodden by the oppressive, arrogant powers. That is what we mean by the spreading of Islamic rule, and it has already begun. Today, other nations throughout the world have fixed their attention on the Iranian nation. They are inspired and motivated by our nation. Today, the anti-domination principles of the Iranian nation have spread to all parts of the Muslim world. If you travel to different Muslim countries, you will notice that their people have a high opinion of your beliefs, motives, and aspirations, regardless of their governments.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The US and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, said Israel expected the IAEA's board of governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the U.S. and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal, officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty, and it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the U.S. and its allies France, Britain and Germany for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The U.S., however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing 2 new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine.
Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia, alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's, in effect, another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. And Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that establish beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the US says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after lunch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader three times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every five children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a US-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to our program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, today we are going to discuss an important issue about religious education. Religious education is an important concept and a very important aspect of Islam. And of course, religion is not only about praying, about fasting, about performing Hajj, but it's also about educating and nurturing human beings and creating a positive and instructive atmosphere whereby individuals who can live together peacefully, because human beings are social creatures and they cannot live separately from one another. They live together, they interact with one another, and therefore they should know how to deal with one another, how to interact with one another. In today's society, of course, a lot of emphasis is placed, unfortunately, on secular education. We know for sure that many countries around the world provide only secular education to their kids and to the people, to the schoolers, and to those who seek knowledge. For example, a child is pushed to strive for excellence in academics. A college or university education is a necessity. There is no doubt about it, both for boys and girls. Education is very much important. But the important question, the important point is that the significance of religious education for a balanced personality must not be overlooked. We need both secular education and, of course, religious education. I could say that education in and of itself is not secular. It is always religious, because seeking knowledge, what kind of knowledge, whatever that kind of knowledge may be, it is essential. It is kind of collective obligation, whether it is about becoming a dentist or an engineer or someone. This may be termed as secular education, but it's not secular in its essence. Because Islam also emphasizes on acquiring these skills, as long as there is a need for any skill in the society, we have to try to acquire those skills, learn them, and of course help our society. But religious education, when we talk about religious education in its specific meaning, we mean education based on Islamic standards, religious values, Islamic doctrines. In modern world, we see that the world in which we are living is producing a generation that knows a lot, but is, of course, greatly deficient in moral and spiritual values. Today's human beings have conquered the space. They have conquered even some planets. For example, they have gone to the moon and they have set foot. They have gone to the Mars. At least they have sent satellites to those places, and they have discovered many, many planets and stars and Milky Ways. They have made remarkable achievements in when it comes to discovering the space. But they have marginalized, sidelined, or overlooked moral and spiritual values to a large extent.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
For example, in modern time we see that children are brought up without any understanding of religion, without any understanding of moral values and moral doctrines. But according to Islam, parents have been given the noble duty of guiding the future generation. It is their task to ensure that their children get a sound religious education. Obviously, nurturing is an important duty of parents. Nurturing. Providing religious education is an important responsibility of parents. In this, of course, they are carrying the work of the prophets who guided the people. What was the responsibility of the prophets? The prophet's responsibility was also to guide human beings to the right path, to provide religious education. That was their duty. And of course, it's also the duty of the parents. And that's why I'm saying that parents are carrying on the work of the prophets. Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara wa quduha an-nasu wal hijara. O you who believe, save yourselves and your families from a fire whose fuel is man and stones. Chapter 66, verse 6. Now, this is a warning given to the families, to the parents especially, and to those who believe that it is your responsibility to protect not only yourselves, but also your families. And to protect from what? Protect from hellfire. Okay. Now, let's remember that nurturing begins right from the time of conception, when a woman conceives, and then nurturing continues until a child's character and personality is shaped. Therefore, it is important for a mother, for a father, what the mother eats and what the father brings home, what the mother sees and what she does not see, and who she interacts with. She should purify her soul, She should purify her inner self. She should avoid eating haram morsel of food. A morsel of haram food will definitely destroy one's efforts to educate his or her child according to Islamic and religious values and doctrines. What the father brings home is very important. It should be something halal, something pure, something allowable. If he brings, God forbid, something which is haram, for example, if he has earned something by way of haram means, and he brings it home and gives it to his children, it will have a lasting impact on his family and on his children. I said that whatever efforts he makes, if he brings something haram for his family to consume, all his efforts to educate his children according to Islamic values and doctrines will be null and void. What exactly is meant by religious education? We shall discuss this with some evidence, with some elements of religious education in the following episode. Obviously, the goal of religious education is to introduce and train good human beings and introduce good human beings to the society. And inshallah, we will discuss these in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. So all I need. Love is all I need.
Operation Cyanide, Part 3.
Operation Cyanide. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out.